Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon. This is Burke Franklin from Business Black Belt Radio, and we are here to give you, I think of it as a reality check. It's really, what do you need to do to build your business? What do you need to do to get your business started? How do you get it financed? I, of course, sell business plan software, but the whole point of that was to have you have software, have a tool to use so you could understand your business. And I think of it as wrapping an idea around your company, or excuse me, wrapping a business around your idea, and where you can, you know, build a business, you come up with a solution, you've solved a problem, you want to make a business and build a life around this idea and make a living on it. And I think that's a great idea. So you can follow your passion, you can do what you want to do, you've got a great thing you've invented, an innovation the world can benefit from, and you can, you know, make a living doing this. And that's what I want to help you do. But there's certain realities to getting there from here. And that's really what Business Black Belt is about, what my software is about, what my guests are about. And today we're talking with Robert Johnson of Business Growth Masters. And Bob spent more than 25 successful years in sales and marketing and general management with Fortune 500 companies and with some small companies. We'll talk about that in a moment. He's directed worldwide marketing and sales organizations. He's consulted to large and small businesses and operated his own small company. So he's an innovative guy. He built an integrated marketing action plan, the Buffalo Sales Communications Program. I'm not sure what that is yet, but we'll find out. And a technology adoption model as a pioneer in bringing total quality to sales and marketing functions. And so the past 10 years, Bob's been really working with small businesses. So he's been a consultant to small businesses in a wide variety of industries as well. And that's important, you know, from, you know, they're different because he's been in biotech, electronics, consumer products, food, metals, plastics, software. And so his present focus is in helping entrepreneurs accelerate their businesses from ideas from startup to launch by applying his marketing expertise with the acquisition of those first customers to get the initial capital. Because most investors want to see, well, what's the customer response to your business? Let's get some customer traction, then we'll invest. So that's one of those things that's, you know, you seem like you need the money first, and then you can build a product, and then you can get some customers. But really, investors want to see what your customers are saying first. So we're going to get to the bottom of this and get a reality check going here. And Bob, welcome. Thank you for being on the Business Black Belt Radio Show.
Well, thank you, Bert. It's a pleasure to join you. I'm looking forward to the next hour. And I thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Is there anything else you want to add to the intro I gave you? I've known you for quite some time. We've done work together and lots of things. And so can you help connect the dots? And what's a Fortune 500 guy doing with small businesses? And how does that make a difference in what you've, you know, anything to say to kick this off?
Well, I'll try to connect a couple of them. Fate is probably the biggest part of that, and you know, how things happen and your business evolves or your personal life evolves over a group of experiences or exposures or, you know, making the right or left turn at Main Street kind of experiences. When I came out of school, I started out in engineering, actually computer science, and gradually evolved over to marketing and sales and business and so on. And, you know, then in those days, a lot of things with high tech and the electronics industry. But through time, I really came to enjoy, to have a passion for new things, new businesses, new ideas, et cetera. And so that's what kind of gravitated me to working with smaller companies and startups. I had an opportunity to participate with a nonprofit consulting company that was set up by the Department of Commerce to help small manufacturing businesses in the Bay Area where I live to access technology and techniques to make them more competitive in the world marketplace. And that really got my interest and passion going. And so since that time, for the last 12 years, I've been working almost entirely focused on working with startups. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Silicon Valley. Yeah. I mean, Silicon Valley seems to be coming, has its ups and downs, and seems to be on an upswing these days. So what are you seeing in business planning now?
Well, there's two groups out there who are dead set on trashing the idea of having a business plan. Group A, I see, has the just make a presentation deck of 15 slides and send it to me, and that'll tell me everything I need to know. Or that's what you need to start with your business. And the other group is the, you know, just do it Nike kind of thing. Just go do it and you'll figure it out. As you know, the unfortunate thing is there's just enough people who have survived that approach to give it more life.
Well, yeah, if the investors know you and that you've made the money before, they can pretty much trust you with a 15-slide PowerPoint deck. But my experience is, you know, you sit in these meetings where the people have their 15 slides and they give you the pitch, and then one person asks one pointed question, and because you haven't really thought the whole thing through, it's like, well, I really haven't thought about that part yet. What do you mean you haven't thought about that part yet, and you're asking me for $1 million? You see that a lot?
Well, not only that, but you know, 15 slides, if you do them well, means you have to be very brief, concise, and precise about almost everything you're going to say.
Yeah.
And for most people, that would be 90-odd percent of them, I know, the way to get brief is to start big and then start chopping and whacking and cutting and editing, and you get down to brevity, not the other way around. You know, most people don't start out being able to explain their business in three sentences. They start out, and again, you and I have been through, we've sat in these meetings where people stand, you know, you're invited to stand up and explain, and they, pardon the expression, prattle on for 3, 4, 5 minutes, and when they sit down, you really don't know any more than when they started, because they just kind of wandered all over the yard talking about pieces of their business. And that's kind of when I work with people, you know, in the early stages, that's kind of what I see most often, is a sort of a lot of semi-connected thoughts that we kind of pound into and carve into a concise message. This is my business. This is what my problem. This is, you know, that kind of thing. So I think the end result of a 15-slide deck that you can send to especially a professional-type investor is probably a good goal, but I don't think you can start there.
Yeah, I think I've seen it where the investors want a preview. Like a lot of people say, oh, no, I want to get my presentation, you know, my secret presentation. And most investors, especially VCs, they don't have time for this. They want to know, you know, give me the summary plan because they want to see if they're even interested. So that's the brochure that sells them even on being interested in the concept. And then they'll say, send me your PowerPoint deck. And you think, no, I don't want to do that. I'm going to give you my presentation. No, send me the PowerPoint deck because I'm going to get a preview on this. But the thing I was going to say, you know, these presentations, I don't think I've ever seen a presentation go where the person gave the presentation for either 10 minutes or 20 minutes, start to finish, uninterrupted. They always get interrupted with, wait a minute. Have you checked in the permits on that, or how many people are going to do this? Like, show me this. Give me an example. What are you talking about? And there's always, you know, interruptions, and the person freaks because, oh, no, I don't have an answer to that yet, or we didn't think about that one, or something. And it's just more often than not the presentation falls apart because they haven't really thought through what's behind any of those 15 slides, not any, but, you know, a lot of the details.
Yeah, the presentation of that style reminds me of, you know, a play. When you go to a live play, if you were able to interrupt the actor in the middle of his soliloquy, the whole play would kind of fall apart because most of the actors have a tough time getting back to that line and moving on. And that's the kind of situation we see in a lot of early presentations, because it's practiced like, okay, don't interrupt me. I go A, B, C, D. And if somebody interjects a question about D before I'm there, then my whole speech is kind of my whole speech is kind of falling apart. And see the same thing, by the way, in creating executive summaries. I'm a strong believer that the executive summary is the end of the planning result, not the beginning. It's kind of fun to start with one and then compare it to the one you finish with. But it's hard to write an executive summary, as most people expect it to be, until you have the business plan. It's kind of like trying to write a synopsis of a play before you've written the play. I mean, yeah. So it doesn't have the punch or the
right
clarity.
What? As I've heard it is, the way the investors get it is they get the elevator pitch, then you get the summary business plan, and then you, which is a couple of pages, and then you get the PowerPoint presentation. And then if they're interested, they get the full-blown business plan. But to get there from here, you start with a full-blown business plan, create the PowerPoint presentation, down, and then boil it, and then make the business plan summary. And then from the summary, you boil it down to the elevator pitch. So the sequence that you presented in is developed in reverse order. And like you say, the whole thing's got to, because, I know we do in Biz Plan Builder, it's a blueprint that shows the whole lay of the land here. Here's all the things you got to cover. It's no good to have something that's chain is as strong as its weakest link. So it's no good to have the whole thing figured out, except you haven't figured out how to deliver the product the last 100 feet to the customer. If you're stuck, and in fact, there was a telco, I remember back in the 80s, that had the whole business, but the one thing they didn't do is figure it out is that last 100 feet to the customer. There was a gap, and the whole thing just fell on its face, although they spent millions of dollars building this business. Well, this leads me to, but a lot of people say, well, can I just get someone to do this for me? How do I don't know how to write a business plan. I don't know how to do this. Can I just hire somebody? What happens there? What do you see there?
Well, again, this is a personal observation and development of, over the years, development of results. I work with a lot of people on their plans, and while I do a fair amount of writing or editing, I don't believe in writing somebody else's business plan or having someone write it. The plan needs to be specific to and developed for the people who are involved. It needs to be, quote, your plan for your business, not just a plan for a business. And the reason behind that is that the process of developing the plan is where it's all at. I mean, that's really the important part of it.
So thinking about it then at that point, huh?
Yeah, I mean, certainly being able to explain it is significant, but the process of putting the plan together, specifically the decisions that are made and the assumptions that are made, are critical not only to explaining it or presenting it to, a source for capital or an employee or a partner, but also important to the review process, which is, in 6 months or a year, when you take a look at where you are, it's always good to know where you thought you'd be and why you thought that. Why don't we have more customers? Well, because if you don't know what you assumed would be your customer acquisition process, rates, et cetera, then you have nothing to look at to change. It just, okay, we start all over again, try again. If your website conversion if you make a business plan based on web conversion, and this is really oversimplifying, but I mean, if your conversion rate is planned at 2% and you're not getting the kind of customers results you're looking for, you can dig down, and if that customer conversion rate is only 1%, you now have something to address. If you don't know that you assume 2%, or you don't remember, or et cetera, then you're just kind of groping. And so it's that process that's key, and that's why the entrepreneur, the founders, the team, the key people really need to be part of the process of developing it. And you know, presenting it to someone else, i.e. an investor, and you and I have all seen these where, as you say, the first question that comes up at Q&A time, the presenter, CEO, gets the deer in the headlight look because he has no idea how that question should be answered or how it was the situation was developed. So, you know, somebody in the audience will say, well, how did you decide to target this market, that this would be your numbers, that your expenses would be thus, and so on? I mean, it's a whole bunch of possible questions. And if they don't know or aren't familiar with the process and the decisions that were made, you know, their presentation just went south.
Yeah, I was on a panel with a bunch of VCs at a business plan competition. I was the one guy with, you know, the business plan software, and these venture capitalists, what were venture capitalists? And we watched one student group after another pitching their business plan. Every single one of them had the magical first-year revenue. Well, the first year we're going to do $1 million in sales. And everybody, we're going to do $1 million in sales. We're going to do $1 million in sales. And I remember one of the breaks, I looked at the four VCs, and I said, do you see this a lot? Like, these guys have this cosmic, mystical $1 million the first year, and can they ever explain how they arrive at it? And they all laughed, and they said, you know, we see that all the time. People are saying, well, first year we do $1 million. And so how is it that you get there from here or get here from there? You know, they don't. I know in the biz plan builder financial model, there's a box that says, you know, who's your market segment? You know, and then, like, for example, my example I always use is, like, say, boat anchors. You know, there's boat anchors for fishing boats, and how many fishing boats are there in the world? You know, so you can get those are empirical fact. I mean, you can get some data that shows here's how many fishing boats there are, or how many sailboats, or how many ski boats, how many super tankers. You can get those numbers, and then the assumptions below it is how many of those fishing boats might buy your anchor. You know, you want to say 3.5% or whatever, and it's going to grow. Here's how we're going to do it, which comes back to your, you know, adoption or penetration numbers that one would need to review to look at. Here's where our assumptions were. Whoa, we're selling way less than we thought. But then at least you could say, okay, if I sent a mailing out where I ran an ad to everybody with a fishing boat and we offered our anchor, and we could see, you could actually construct how you would come up with $1 million for the first year. You have to send X number of mailers out or run an X number of ads, invest a certain amount of money in advertising, get a certain response to sell enough to raise and have $1 million in revenue. But if you say, well, my response has to be a 50% response to my mailing, because no one gets a 50% response to a mailing, so that's completely unrealistic. So from there you have to reverse engineer and figure out, okay, if I got a 2-3-1%, 0.25%, if the email is going to get about 0.001%, you know, you could actually arrive at some reasonable first-year number. But you have to do it from the bottom up. You can't just say, oh, we're going to do $1 million the first year, and after that we're going to go 50% a year.
Yeah. Well, actually, sometimes it's even we're going to do $1 million the first year, and then we're going to double every year after that, or double and triple, and then you get the real hockey stick out there where it just kind of leaps off the top of the page as it goes from $1 million to $5 million to $50 million, you know. And
yeah,
if anyone's ever been around a company, and involved in a company that was growing like that, they would appreciate what they just wrote down on the paper. You know, I was fortunate or unfortunate enough to be involved in one of those situations. And when I had this company that started out as a small company. I think I mentioned it in the electronics world, and we were growing. We were doing very nicely, and one of the big boys in the industry came in and said, we want to open up. At that time, I was living in St. Louis. So we want to open up an office in St. Louis, and we'd rather buy your office, you know, buy you, basically, and open up that way than start and be your competitor. So we had this thing called a merger, quote, unquote. But anyway, the company that we merged with was, or that bought us, was growing both internally and externally at, you know, compounded rates of 300-500%. So, you know, the first year that we were part of the company, it was $25 million in sales. In the third year, it was $125 million. And believe me, that is, it's like being on the end of crack the whip. You know, you're just getting thrown all over the place because it's real hard to hold on to
keep up with that.
What you're really trying, you know, it's the alligators and the swamp and all those other things that we hear. It really does happen fast, and you're kind of skimming the tops.
Yeah. But it seems like a high class problem.
It's growing with these tests. It's a lot better than going the other way. But
yeah.
But it's still, in terms of the things that can happen, you know, in terms of things like the restaurant that you go to once, it's pretty good. You go back the second time and it's mobbed. And the third time, you know, and the food's not so, you've been through this. The third or fourth time you go back, it's not there anymore because you grew so fast. It just couldn't keep a hold of itself.
They just implode.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a big part of a long-term business plan and strategy, which is, of course, getting the customer is the first major step, but you got to keep them. If you don't keep them, then you're constantly looking for new ones. And, you know, then it becomes a sort of a business Ponzi type scheme. You just have to keep scratching and clawing. And it's real hard to grow a business that way, you know.
I've worked in companies like that in seminar companies. It was always go get the new customer. When really you find out that it costs only 1/5 or 20% of effort and expense to sell the existing customer the next product. You'd be better off with this restaurant rather than trying to get a bunch of new restaurant customers is having the same people come back over and over again. So you dial in the service, you have the good food, you stop all this effort to build, growing with new people, but you focus on having the existing customers. And that's why we did the business plan. And then, well, what else, if they like the BizPlan Builder, what else are they going to like? Well, that's when Marketing Builder and Publicity Builder and other things that we could offer them that would help them do the next thing. And so it was just easier to sell the same customer the next product than it was to keep scrounging for more customers. Anyway.
Absolutely.
There's a
study from the insurance industry of, I don't know, 30 years ago now probably, but it hasn't changed much. And if you look at their behavior today, it certainly, they don't think it's changed much. And that study basically led them to the belief that if you have one policy, one relationship with a customer, they are 5 times more likely to leave you than if you have 2 relationships. And so I forget now the exact numbers, 3 times less likely if you have 3 relationships. And essentially, if you have 4, that is basically look at what they do, car, boat, home, life, whatever, airplane. If you have 4 policies or 4 relationships with a client, they're going to stay with you for life. So why wouldn't they give you a 10% discount or a 20% discount for each one? That's the reason they behave the way they do. You know, that's the reason you see all these ads for, you know, bring your home, bring your bundle, bring your this, because they know, you know, you're going to go out tomorrow and go, okay, I'm going to go through all this process and find 4 new insurance companies, one for my car insurance, one for my boat, you know.
Yeah, well, I just hear real
I'm
good.
I'm sure they're not the only industry that's that way.
Sure. Let me change tack a little bit here. You mentioned the other day we were talking. You talked about selecting your capital strategy early on. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. What are you thinking there?
Well, a couple of quick things. Number one, there's depending on who you talk to, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can bring capital into a business. Now, they don't necessarily all apply to a brand new startup, nor are they necessarily appropriate for a well-established business. But there's a lot of different ways to do it, and you know, there are variations, permutations, combinations, etc. And they're each one of them has certain positives and negatives, plus, you know, as well as approaches and attractors. So just like when you're developing a product, okay, if you develop a product and then say, okay, I've got this neat thing, who do I sell it to? That is usually going to be more difficult and therefore more time-consuming and therefore more expensive. Then the other end of it, which is, okay, I'm developing this product for this market. Let's work with this market and move back and forth. So this product develops, when it's finished, it is for this market. And they recognize that it's for them, or they certainly feel like it's just for them. Okay. And the same thing is true, in my opinion, of a capital strategy. If you are looking for, you know, $50,000, you have a strategy for that that is different than if you're looking for $50 million. And if you need $50,000 now and $50 million later, then you have to have that, as you mentioned before, you have to have that strategy and the plan that goes with it that shows how you're going to take the steps from $50,000 to $50 million and how you're going to do it in a way that doesn't negate the next step.
So in other words, you know, if you need ultimately $50 million, you rarely need the $50 million all at once. You need, plus you don't want to sell that much of your company at a low valuation early on, because early on the company's not worth that much. So you might want to raise $500,000 when the company's got a low valuation, so you don't give up the whole lot for $500,000. And then later on you might raise, I'll just use simple math in tens. After that you might raise, okay, with $500,000 you built the business to X. And then you raise $5 million, and you build a company to Y. And then after that, you get to raising the $50 million, because now you've got two steps of financing, two rounds of financing. But then you've also built a lot of value in the business. So when you sell it for $50 million or go public or whatever you do, you still have, you know, you haven't coughed up so much of the company early on that you actually have something left.
Well, you do it in a way, again, as the owner, founder of the company, you do it in such a way that even though your percentage of ownership is diluted, the value of what you own afterward is worth more than what you owned before. That's the key secret. So if you own 100% of a $1,000 business, you know, that's great. But if you could own 50% of a $100,000 business, gee, something happened there, you know. And so
like you have a slice of pie, and it's not a matter of how big. Well, ideally the pie gets bigger. So as your slice overall compared to the pie gets smaller, your slice is actually weighs more than, you know, previous weight of your slice.
Exactly. Yeah. The bigger the pie, the smaller the slice, still weighs more than the smaller pie. You keep moving forward in that direction. And the beauty of that is that that's good for everybody, because if that's working for you, the entrepreneur, the founder, that's also happening for your early supporters, your early investors, your second round of investors, and everybody in the process. As the company grows in value, disproportionately to the amount of capital brought in, everybody's making out. And, you know, you don't have any of these issues with down rounds and ratchets and things of all that ilk that, you know, we don't want to get involved in. Because if what's left is worth more than what you had, it's a good thing.
The other thing I know you talk about in here that I agree with too, and it's, I consider it bootstrapping, but part of the strategy, and you know, a lot of people think, well, I gotta raise a bunch of money, and I think, well, have you written your plan yet? Have you developed some relationships with potential vendors? Have you got some potential customers lined? Have you got any relationships and strategic alliances in place? You know, and like, what other things can you do that don't cost money, so you don't have to raise money? You can actually build your business and do a lot of things that, in my perception, it seems like, you know, the more I could do with no money would be more impressive to an investor. Like, wow, look what you're doing. You're building this business with or without an investment. And so we'll talk about that. Like, what kind of things can you do that don't cost big bucks to put together?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do that don't cost big bucks, but the first things you should do, regardless, don't cost much. And that really is about getting things going in the right direction. It's kind of like standing at the intersection of instead of being a four-way intersection, it's like a 10-way intersection, or like an opening in the middle of a clearing in the middle of a forest, and there's 9 paths leading off from it. And that you have to decide which one to take, and you don't have to take them at 100 miles an hour. If you go 10 steps into this path, and you can do some things to find out that's not leading you where I want to go, it's not too hard to make a change. If that makes sense. And so some of the first things that we always tell people to do, even almost before you do anything, number one, you have an idea. Convert the idea into what we call a problem statement. And a problem statement is the broadest concept of it. In other words, what problem is this going to solve? What need is this going to fulfill? What want is this going to take care of? And this is the beginning of the process, because there's a lot of people running around and this is a wonderful thing. And when you try to really hammer out the problem statement, it becomes a big challenge.
Silicon Valley, it seemed like there's a lot of people with solutions looking for problems. They didn't really have a. And when I tell people today, like, what problem does your business solve, and who's got it, and how many of them are there? You know, and if you don't have that figured out, that's your starting point, really.
The idea is nifty, but if it doesn't have a problem that it solves in the largest sense, it really is just a nifty idea, you know. And from the problem, then your next little step is, okay, who has the problem? You know, and who cares about it? Okay, is this? And once you write down who has this problem, you very quickly sort of get an inkling: is this, you know, just my next door neighbor, you know, or just me, or is it actually every second person down the block and around the world has this problem? In other words, what we're really trying to do is get not a definitive answer, but sort of a scale. In other words, okay? And so the second thing then you can do from that is what we call build your constituency, or at least start building a constituency. And the beauty of that in our mind is that you can begin to talk to people about the problem. You're not really sacrificing, if you do it right, you're not really sacrificing any intellectual property, trade secret kind of thing, because you're not talking about a solution yet. You're just talking about the problem.
Yeah. Okay.
And so you can begin to find people who are interested in or have or want to solve this problem. And now, again, you sort of get a small constituency, kind of like a groundswell if you were going to run for an office, okay? And from that, you can kind of pick what we call your first team, which is kind of a vision team, which maybe 2 or 3 people to help you begin to put out in from your mind into words what your vision is for this. What are you going to do with this? Okay, we got an idea, we got a problem. we got something, we got a potential solution. What do we want to do with it? And kind of get an understanding of what that might be, as you were talking about. You're going to build this big company, going to try to be another, General Motors or Facebook or whoever it might be. Or would you really be much happier, if you could develop it a little further, sell it to somebody, license it to somebody, whatever. Because those three or four things then begin to really start to lay out where in this clearing, which direction you should head. Okay. Once you have a few people on your, quote, team, then you can come back and revisit the idea of the competition and the market. And we're not talking about detailed analysis, but, kind of get a grip on it. Is there 10 competitors? 2? 1,000? None? What?
You're right.
And there's almost never none.
Yeah, that alone it seems like a real bozo no-no in any investment presentation is to suggest, well, we don't have any competition. That's just like, okay, you're delusional, or you missed the boat, or something or other, because there's going to be competition. I remember Scott Cook, of Intuit, talking about Quicken way back when, and somebody asked him about his competition. He held up a checkbook and a pen and a calculator and said, this is my competition. It's not necessarily another direct competitor. It was, if I can't make balancing your checkbook easier than balancing your checkbook with a pencil in your check register and a calculator, well, good am I. And so that really was an interesting analogy. You got competition.
Yeah. Okay. For sure.
And then, so you need to have that all pointed out.
Well, these are things that you can do, that, don't cost a lot of money, take some time, but start to give you a real grip on it. The other key thing is, if you decide that you want to start a business, then you really should look at getting your personal house in order. Whether that's finances or your relationships or whatever, is the reason for starting a business. Because, quite frankly, I talk to a lot of people that want to start a business because they're in financial trouble, or they've just been laid off, and they see this as a solution to their financial problems. And ultimately, it may be, but it is not an immediate solution that can come about. So, I don't encourage anyone to start a business because they need to make an income right away. If that's the choice, then
problem, Bob, you there? I've lost him. Bob, call back.
Geared to.
Okay.
That's what that type of business is geared to. It's geared to people who want to, quote unquote, buy a job, and there's nothing wrong with that. Just that's what it is.
Right.
But if you really have this idea and you want to build this company, and it's again knowing and recognizing that. One of my friends explained it, says he used to think that, when I started my business, I was going to get to work half days. And now I get to decide, now that I've done it, I get to decide whether I want to work from noon to midnight or midnight to noon.
Not going to happen overnight, that's for sure. Yeah.
It's a lot more than perhaps one might expect until one has done it. So those are just some of the basics. There's more, but you're leading to what I would call the first level of plan, okay? And this is a sort of a philosophy of ours, is that I don't believe business plan should be written like a term paper or a midterm exam. That is, you sit down one afternoon, like most of us have tried to do, and just create this thing. It's really an iterative process, So what we want to do with people, and this is one of the things I like about using BizPlan Builder, as a tool, is that you can begin pretty easily and, you know, park stuff in places, and it gives you a nice framework, and you can go back and revisit, re-edit, add to, plus, expand, and you know, keep growing it. So our first sort of working with an entrepreneur right out of the, you know, idea stage is to get to, you know, first level plan, what you might call a feasibility or a concept. It's maybe a couple of pages. It may not even be, you know, dialogue. It may be notes and paragraphs, kind of, you know, they're explaining pieces with a real basic high-level set of numbers. But fundamentally answers the question, you know, is this possible or is this a pipe dream? You know, if you have an idea to make something that costs $1,000 and everybody that's got the problem today is solving it, whether they like the way they're solving it, for $100, it's not going to happen for you.
Yeah. Let's move on to target markets. I've got a few two more questions I want to ask you here. We're about halfway through them and more than halfway through the show. So, like, target markets, you go briefly into how to choose your target markets, because we mentioned, you know, like, more isn't always better. So you don't want to have, like, 100 target markets. You want to have, what, a handful, I would imagine. But how do you choose them and prioritize them? What would you say there?
Well, here's philosophy first. Jack Welch used to say when he took over GE, if you're not 1, 2, or 3 in your marketplace, you either have to be getting there or you get out. And if you do some analysis on all of that sort of thing, in order to be 1, 2, or 3, you need to be somewhere in the teens percentage of market. 15% is kind of a nice round number. So if you got 15% of a market, then you're most likely going to be one of the top three guys, okay? So the key is to define a market and select a market where you can get to be fairly quickly, you know, not, I don't mean jump to $1 million kind of thing, but fairly quickly get to be a 15% market share. If that means using a subset of a bigger market or even a subset of a subset, then that's what you should look to do. Okay, so that's the first step. Define a market and pick one where your position, skills, knowledge, resources can readily lead you to see a path to a 15% market share. Okay? And I would always start with one, because if you get to be 15%, in other words, if you get to be a 15% share of a market, let's just assume for the sake of game, we're talking about selling to left-handed doctors who play golf on Wednesday. Okay? I mean, sometimes you have to get real creative to get the market target. You're going to be not immune, but fairly invulnerable to big boys coming into the market, because they won't understand how to get to that particular market as efficiently and effectively as you have.
I think that's Richard Branson's MO.
Pardon?
I mean, Richard Branson's MO is, as I understand it, he goes into big markets like airlines. Are you kidding? But he goes into this big market knowing there's a big market there, but he does. You know, like he recognizes there's this big market, but there's one painful thing that they do that he fixes. And so if you're, you know, traveling and you want a better travel experience in a certain way, you go Virgin because, you know, Virgin offers this one twist that makes it interesting, and he can get a little small chunk out of a gigantic market. So rather than, then there's the whole Blue Ocean strategy, which is create a market that there's nobody in, create your own market, which is really what I did back with BizPlan Builder in the beginning. There was nobody selling business plan software. It didn't exist. I made the first one. And so, of course, now Google has a zillion people, you know, trying to knock this thing off, and they, you know, they've imitated me from the outside in, but they really don't know the inside out part of it. But anyway, that aside, so there's the, you know, there's the Blue Ocean strategy, and then there's the, you know, go after like the Richard Branson strategy. So I can, and then there's Jack Welch. So it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, in all the years I've been around, I've heard the 1% strategy, 100,000 times. We're going to get 1% of this huge market, and I contend you can't get 1% of a market. You're either going to get a lot more of it, or you're going to get a lot less of it. And if you are shooting for a huge market that you're trying to get 1% of, you're going to be, again, you're back on the end of the crack the whip. You're going to be vulnerable to the people who are there.
Well, I've heard a zillion times that people, the proverbial 1%, if you even say, we're going to get 1%, of the Chinese market, for example, which would be huge, or any market, that just says, I mean, 1% is so easy to say, but it just triggers the thought, the response of any semi-sophisticated investor even is going to say, oh, obviously you haven't done the math. Obviously you don't really know how big your market is. You don't really know what penetration level you're going to get. You don't know what percentage of that market you're really going to get. You're just throwing 1% because it sounds good and it creates a big number. And I look at, I saw some studies, there's 388 million businesses in the world. Well, if I had a million businesses paying me $100 a month, I'd have a hell of a business. But a million out of 388 million is only 0.26% of the global available market to me. So
right.
I would say if I got 0.26 of my market, I'd get a million customers. If I could get them paying me $100 a month, you could live on that. So it's a number that came from a couple of places. And, yeah, the million customers is a round number, but I could at least say that 0.26 of an available market. I could say if I got, a quarter of that, it's like if I got 0.0, whatever the number is, at least it's something that's something calculated, something that's got a little more insight to it than just a plain old 1%. I think that's what the 1% means, is that you've really not looked at this market and you really don't know what you're talking about. So if you even use the words 1% in your investment presentation or in your business plan, you're going to get thrown out on your ear. I would just
assert that that comes right after there's no competition.
Yeah, okay, that's a favorite.
That's a second conversation ender. We don't have any competition and we're going to get 1% of the market. Your conversations are pretty much done. So, you're much better to pick and pick. You really are not picking, you're defining a market that you're going to target that is a subset of a larger market, but that you can penetrate quickly and deeply so that you're much less vulnerable to any event that occurs beyond your control, competition, economics, et cetera.
Yeah.
Then you can go pick another one.
As long as we're on some of these, I'd like to talk about, what bubbles people have these ideas about writing business plans and raising capital and starting businesses. One of the questions I asked you wanted to ask here is that where most people's bubbles get burst, and how do they get beyond it? How do we reset some expectations, and how do we, obviously graciously pop some bubbles so they don't get hurt by this mislead thinking?
Well, in spite of context of the conversation, we're talking about business plans. One of the first ones is business plans. I need a business plan that'll get me capital. And, my answer is business plans don't raise capital. People do. Okay. So, business plan, you have to have it. It doesn't mean you can't. You can do without it. But don't expect it to do something that it is not capable of doing. So, I get a lot of people going, hey, I've set my business plan to pick a number, 200, all these people and nothing's happening. Well, first of all, that's the wrong way to do it, and second of all, it's the wrong tool to use. So, as we discussed earlier, sending a full business plan cold to somebody is, you might as well just open the window and throw it out. It just isn't how it happens, The variation of the product scenario in the capital scenario of the variation of build it and they will come, only in the field of dreams did that happen. if you don't have a way of getting people to know about what you're doing, or in this case about your deal or your opportunity, and do it within, you know, compliance with the laws and the regulations, then it's just not going to happen. There's a myth that, especially for early stage, I'm speaking now about early stage companies, that capital sources invest or loan or get involved because of the return, and that all they have to do is show them a big return and things will happen. Yes, people who invest and or lend expect, want, do, you know, need a big return or a proper return. But from our experience, we found that before the check actually happens, actually even almost before the conversation begins, there are really two conditions that are always in existence when the check happens. And those two are the capital source investor resonates with the problem that you're addressing. Now, I use the word resonate because it isn't always exactly the same, but there's something more than a casual, oh, that's nice response, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost visceral. And two, they have a connection or form a connection with the founder or one or at least one member of the team. There's more than just, you know, Burke's a nice guy, seems okay, you know, kind of thing. There's more there than that. There's the credibility, the confidence, the trust. Those kind of things are in place before somebody decides to write a check. Okay? And those two things, the first one you can sort of do in a 6 to 8 minute presentation, the second one you really can't. So if you stand up in front of an angel group to give your 8 minute presentation, you know, people are not going to come running up to the front of the room after you're done and start handing you checks. You've got to have a process that you, just like a customer acquisition process, an investor or capital acquisition process is in fact a process. There's steps that happen, and you have to be ready for each step, and you have to know what those steps are and how you can help move the source through those steps, just like you would move a prospect through the steps to buying your product.
Is there anything you can explain real quick on what they are right now? I mean, we talked about the, you know, the elevator pitch, the summary plan, the full-blown business plan. But those that you could have, you know, in some cases you could write, have a private placement memorandum ready to go where individual investors could write checks and your PPM, so to speak, has got the full disclosure on what this investment's about. Then the VCs, on the other hand, are going to have their own paperwork with their own deal. They'll give you a term sheet if they're interested. But,
they're really not different. We just use different words. First of all, you got to get their attention, gain their interest.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, you can decide very quickly whether this guy's really interested in, you know, business plan software, or if he's off wanting to cure, you know, diabetes or something. You know, because everybody's not interested in everything, and if they're not interested, they're not interested. You know, I mean. It really isn't going to matter that your product could give them 2 times the return of something else if they're not interested. They're not interested. Again,
they also have
resonates with the problem.
They also have to believe that you have the horsepower to do it. I mean, I went to this. We even have both went to this business conference that we, you know, taught at, and these people say, "I need money for my business," and have a great idea. And I look at them and I think, you got a great idea here, but, you know, you don't have the horsepower to build this business. I mean, some people just don't. And at the time, they also didn't have a team. I mean, you could compensate for that. Like, okay, I'm a doctor. I've got this invention. Well, okay, you have a horsepower, I suppose, to make the invention and the technical expertise behind what it should do, but you don't have the so-called wherewithal to build a team and manage a business and raise the capital and build a company. So you better show up with, here's my business people, here's my business manager, here's my CEO, and here's my technology person, and here's my salesperson. I'm going to be the medical director of this thing. And okay, so now between you, you got the horsepower to build a business. But if you show up and don't have the so-called horsepower to build a business, that to me is a problem.
There's a line in Clint Eastwood's, every one of Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry movies that I use in this part of the conversation, and that is a man's got to know his limitations. And in this case, it isn't just man, but a person. A person's got to know their limitations. And if you aren't a CEO, then don't try to be one. You know, one of the most crushing questions I've heard from angels and VCs when they're listening to presentations or get into discussions is, you know, a founder's talking about this and they get into a discussion about who's going to do what. And, you know, like, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to be the CEO. And the investor says, why? And that, believe me, stops about 50% of the people right now, you know. And the answer is, well, that's my idea. Well, you're done.
Yeah, that's the good.
You're done again. You know, it's not good enough. Yeah, I have the skills or I something, you know.
Well, and a couple other things we hear a lot are things like, you know, my idea is so great, everyone's going to want to invest. And all I need is money. And if I can get in front of people with the money, they'll invest. And
yep.
I mean, if I had a buck for every time I heard any one of those things, I'd be rich. What's your experience there? And what do you say to people who are saying that?
It's an outgrowth of they want people that just introduce me or whatever. And it's again, in most early stage investments, not about the product or the business or whatever. It's really about the people. You know, if you were going to invest your money in a brand new idea, what are you investing in? The idea? Well, maybe. But really, what you're looking at investing in is the people or persons. Do they have something that connects with you that says they're going to make this happen? Now, it doesn't mean that they have to grow a $50 million business all by themselves, but something that says they're going to take this, whatever amount you're investing, and move the business forward to where something else can happen. You can bring in a CEO or you can add, you know, something else can happen that makes it available to move to the next stage. There's a great book written back in I guess it's about the 80s. It's called From Barbarians to Bureaucrats, and it traces the steps that a company grows through from start to either success or death. But you know, in the beginning, there has to be the barbarian, and this is the person, usually the founder, but not always. This is the person who says, you know, full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes, we're going to make this happen, take no prisoners, that kind of attitude that says, I don't care what barrier you put in front of us, we're going to overcome it. Okay. And that's important. They believe the passion, the dedication, et cetera, makes them want to make that happen. And that usually comes out from the founder. But there's also a place where that attitude becomes no longer a value, but actually a detriment. You know?
Yeah.
Because it very quickly turns, as the business grows, it can quickly turn to my way or the highway. And if you need people, you know, skilled, talented people to build this business.